Welcome to the Total Soccer Show. My name is Ryan Bailey, and today we are going to be reviewing this week's tranche of Champions League games. I'm still not tired of saying that word. Joining me to do so is a man who puts it on target every single time, unlike Ousmane Dembele. It's Taylor Rockwell!
Hello! I appreciate that one. It's a positive introduction. Thank you for that, Ryan. Still don't know what a tranche is. I think listener question asker from yesterday, Ira Jersey, has offered to explain it. Maybe I will take him up on that, and then I will finally be able to get your references.
Joining Taylor and I is a man who's progressing to the quarterfinals of awesome analysis, Joe Lowry.
That might be my favorite one yet. It's the most flattering to me. Ryan, thank you for that, and it's great to be here.
All the goats always make it through to the quarterfinals. That's something that we've learned from this week, right? So that's why I wanted to give that one to you, Joe. Before we start today's proceedings, gents, I have some grievances to air.
Uh-oh.
Please.
Yeah.
The listener question situation.
Show,
all right.
The listener question show that went out this week with Mr. Snaves and Mr. Rockwell. Very good indeed. But Joe, I don't know if you listened to it, but you and I were slighted on this episode.
Taylor
Rockwell, he held us as liars. He said that neither of us have wasted our time watching or reading Harry Potter, but Taylor accused us of lying that we had actually seen it. He thinks we have the time and inclination to watch a children's movie about wizards and that we'd be too embarrassed to admit it. I think we're both nerdy enough to have admitted that thing if we'd have done it. But frankly, I felt hurt by that Taylor didn't think we were telling truthies. And I felt I was telling truthies. Are you telling truthies, Joe?
I was telling truthies. I'd never thought to express it in that way before. But yeah, Taylor, I think Ryan and I now have a joint grievance against you. We can work all this out at some point, I hope. We're going to need maybe some group counseling here. But yeah, Ryan, thanks for bringing that up. I appreciate that.
All right.
We'll do it right
then
now.
I'm going to come to my own defense here. That's what's going to happen now. Because here's what, neither of you has ever verbalized a particular dislike for the Harry Potter franchise. Is that fair to say? Neither of you has any reason. You're not anti-witch. You're not anti-wizard. Is that fair to say?
I'm right in the middle.
Fair.
All right. Ryan?
Yeah, fair.
All right. So to me, Harry Potter is so ubiquitous. Like, it's on various cable channels at various points. Ryan, you have two daughters. The books are everywhere. The audiobooks are everywhere. Where that came from was sort of like, I feel like you have to have seen at least a little bit of one of the movies. Are you claiming that you have never read or heard one of the books or never seen any of the movies?
The books are in my home. My wife is fanatical. We have been to Harry Potter's Wizarding Expensive
See.
World of Nonsense in Florida. But I've still avoided at all costs seeing the movies or reading the books.
First of all, I appreciate you giving it its proper title, which is outstanding. And one of my biggest fears now that I'm a dad is how many things I'm going to have to go to and attend that I'm like, oh, great. It costs that much? Awesome. But I have to do it. Great. Great.
Daddy, can I have a butter beer? No, it's called beer. It's $9 and they won't tell me what it is. So no.
Did you get the butterbeer, though? Because I do kind of want to know what butterbeer tastes like.
I had 6 butterbeers. I was hammered.
Attaboy. And Joe, what about you? Have you ever seen or heard or read any Harry Potter?
I don't think outside of maybe, you know, flipping around on TV, mm-hmm. back when kind of TV mm-hmm. was still more of a thing than it is now, and seeing a movie and being, oh, what's that? And then looking at the guide and it saying, oh, it's Harry Potter 4 or whatever, and then continuing on. I think that's about my... That's all my experience with Harry Potter. So I'm glad that you found someone in Adam Snavely who could properly address that question from Ira, and you two could go back and forth and have yourselves a good time.
I enjoy that I didn't even, I think I assumed both of you would, because I think the question was meant for me and Joe from Ira. And so I just kind of assumed that Joe would have the Harry Potter background. He did not. So then I was like, oh, well, Ryan, obviously, well, we'll just answer that one. And when both of you said that you had no Harry Potter background, I was confused, especially because listeners can't see this because we're recording just the audio, but we have the video in front of us. Ryan and Joe both have the Harry Potter sorting hat on. I don't know how both of you are wearing it, but like, I see a lot of Harry Potter decorations in the background, so I just feel like this is all a little bit disingenuous.
Oh, the man in the store told me this was all the cool kids were wearing. It's jaunty. I didn't know it was a sorting hat. I must admit, when I put on the listener questions episode yesterday, my thumb was hovering over the plus 30 seconds button for a while, thinking, do I want to subject myself to this? This sounds like it could go long. We're picking several.
I'm going to guess you were not alone in that.
I'm glad I stuck with it, though, because it was very entertaining, even if I don't quite get the references to the positions and whatnot. But I had to call you up on something. You were compiling US-based teams for the men and women Mm-hmm. Taylor, I think you picked Yunus Musa in yours. I think there was an error there.
Hey, we talked about it. It may well be the reason why he ends up not playing for the United States, because he's like, I don't want these people covering me. But there's always a chance that he listens to it, and maybe he's a huge Harry Potter fan. We know Weston McKinney is. I think that's where the question came from, the origin of it. So there's always a chance that maybe he listens and thinks, like, if I'm not being included, why am I even? I'm just going to go play where Harry Potter's from instead of in the United States.
He's from Italy?
It all makes sense, oh, right? Spain? It all makes sense.
Oh, I get it. We're talking about England now. Okay, I'm following the conversation completely. I do have one other thing I have to bring up about Snaves. I believe you refer to him as the Baron Lord Snavington. Is that correct?
That is correct. Mm-hmm.
My knowledge of British nobility and titles is limited, but I think a baron is a lord, or at least you call a baron a lord. So you've got a tautological nickname for him there. How do you feel?
I feel like it's representative of his importance to the British Empire, and that he has double esteem. And then I do feel bad, though, because I didn't give him his full name. Joe and Adam talked about this previously. For those who don't know, his full name is Adamuel. So it's Baron Lord Adamuel Snavington is his full name. Took me a minute there. I got it out eventually.
Wonderful. All right. Let's go on and talk about soccer, shall we?
From both of you.
I think we've exhausted this banter. Let's talk about some soccer. We had Champions League games this week, which we're going to talk about. We got Juventus, who took on Porto. Dortmund took on Sevilla. And on Wednesday, some slightly less entertaining, but no less worthy of talking about matches, Liverpool against Leipzig and PSG against Barcelona. The headline kind of coming into or coming out of this tranche of games is that both the GOATs are out on the same match day, if you will. Messi and Ronaldo on consecutive nights, if you will. And the new GOATs, both through Haaland and Mbappe. First time since 2004-05 without either Messi or Ronaldo in the quarterfinals. Taylor, end of an era? Or just something that we just say to make this sound more interesting than it is?
I mean, it's a representation of the era. If you go with Jamie Carragher, who was using all of that to argue that Liverpool will inevitably win the Champions League, that was his post-match analysis insight. It is strange to have both of them out. I think it's stranger for me to have Messi no longer involved, just because in watching these two games and thinking about this, because I watched them live and then after the fact, I've rewatched decent chunks of all these games, thinking about, like, Messi does have that, as we saw with his goal, that ability to just out of nowhere, he can create something and you can never really chalk him off because at a certain point he can slalom through and score a goal. Ronaldo, I don't know if he, in my mind at least, like, has that, as much of that ability anymore. I think he can still obviously score goals and create. I'm not trying to disparage him, but I just think Messi has that other element of, like, you can never take your eye off him for a second because otherwise he's going to create something. So it is sort of strange to not have him involved anymore. And I did continuously think, especially when he gets that penalty, and which is ends up being saved, it felt like, oh, here we go. This is the comeback. They're going to go in halftime 2-1. They're going to come out. PSG are going to be nervous and we're going to get some sort of turnaround. And we didn't. So here we are. And now we have the youngsters paving the way and scoring goals and talking trash.
And speaking of youngsters, Joe, you're a little younger than old man Rockwell and I. And I was thinking, you know, Messi and Ronaldo have been on the scene for what, 15, 16 years. That's a large proportion of your soccer watching time that they've been part of the furniture, right?
Yeah, it's weird to think of soccer without Messi and Ronaldo for me. And I think that goes for a lot of other younger folks as well, who kind of have seen them be attached to the game for so long. But to be honest, it's kind of, I don't know. This isn't meant to be harsh to anyone in particular, but it's kind of a welcome change. I don't think that one era is completely over now because of two games that happened midweek in 2021, right? That is not going to ultimately define the end of this era. It is a good landmark to show the changing of the tide in some senses, but I think I'm looking forward to getting a look at other players at a higher level of spotlight. That's not really a term, but I'm making it one. I'm looking forward to seeing Mbappe and Erling Haaland continue to make their mark on soccer, because they are both tremendously entertaining players to watch. Just like Messi and Ronaldo have been for so long, we are seeing more incredibly talented and incredibly fun superstars come to the top, and that excites me.
You know what excites me? Hearing what you've got to say, Joe, as the dictator of Porto, about the first match we're going to be talking about. Juventus against Porto. This one finished 3-2 on the night to the old lady. 4-4 on aggregate with Porto going through on away goals. I've got thoughts on away goals. We can handle those in a second. But for the first up, Joe, 10-man Porto getting this job done against Juventus. Can we start with where Conceição went right with this team?
I think he went right by having a roughly similar game plan to the first leg. So they come out of the first leg up 2-1. They give up that away goal towards the end of the game, and that is a tough pill to swallow for Porto. But Conceição comes into this game and has a roughly similar idea of how he wants his team to play. He's playing to their strength. So when you look at the lineup for Porto on paper or on your computer, whatever, it's a 4-4-2. But in real life, in this game, it actually wasn't. So they took that 4-4-2. And they had one of the strikers, Marega, drop down into midfield. Then they had the two wide midfielders, the left mid and the right mid, drop into the back line for large stretches of this game. Not unlike Barcelona did against PSG back in their first leg a few weeks ago. So that 4-4-2 from Conceição turned into a 6-3-1. And it's a weird shape, and it did some weird things, and it allowed Juve to do some good things, or Juve was smart enough and skilled enough to take advantage of some weaknesses in that shape. But the idea of the 6-3-1 that Porto played was to congest space and to make life miserable for Juventus and to congest midfield, to have Marega providing an extra number there so they have three there instead of two, and then to have extra width because Juve like to have Cuadrado pushing up on one side and like to have width on the other side. It came in the form of Chiesa in this game. They like to stretch you wide, and Porto knew that coming into this. Conceição knew that and said, no, we're going to counteract that with our six-man back line so we can cover width and we can actually have numbers in midfield. And I think by and large, until Porto go down a man, that shape works out fairly well.
Yeah, I would like to go off of what Joe said then. Even when they do go down a man, I think like the commentators kept saying they were now in like a 6-2-1. What I saw was maybe sometimes they were that, but a lot of times it seemed to me that they were still in a 5-3-1 because they wanted that three-man midfield to be able to still apply pressure a little bit higher up the field. And I would argue that that's where some of those changes end up needing to be made. Some of the substitutions happen because that midfield three does get a bit more tired and then they don't close down as much. And I think that's kind of how you they are able to get better service and get some of those goals back. But I think, to Joe's point, the defensive approach combined with still having that like midfield three and the presence there confounded Juve a little bit. And I think also sort of focused in on some of the problems that Juve had and some of the lineup or the formation issues that their approach suggested.
Some very impressive performances from Porto, gent, but perhaps the star of the back five or the back six, if you will, was Pepe, 38-year-old Pepe, who had a brilliant game doing overhead clearances in the dying minutes and just generally just being an absolute force and terrorizing Juventus at every available opportunity. Joe, at what point does Pepe get a statue in Porto up erected next to your statue?
Right. Well, it's going to be shorter, right? It's going to be shorter and smaller. But we will work on that process ASAP. Pepe will be getting a statue. It will be cool, but again, not as cool as mine.
Very good, very good. Taylor, can we talk about Juventus' formation as well? Can you explain to me what they were doing? Because I was trying to follow this. It was ostensibly a 4-4-2, but not, because sometimes it was a 3-6-something. Tell me what was going on here.
Yeah, so I think I've seen it listed as a 4-4-2 pretty consistently. For me, it was that at times, especially defensively. But when they were attacking, when they were trying to be proactive or maybe apply pressure higher up the field, it felt more like a 4-3-3 with Chiesa joining the attack and being one of that like kind of frontline three, and then Ramsey moving very central. And you'd have a kind of congested three in the midfield, and that I think ideally gave you width that wide with overlapping runs from the fullbacks if you wanted that. I think the problem for Juve, in my mind at least, was that Ronaldo, given free license to roam, can pop up wherever he wants, but isn't then going to do the defensive job. So there's times when he drifts out to the left, then Chiesa goes central, and if Juve lose the ball, Ronaldo's not tracking back, so Chiesa has to. And if you are going to defend in that 4-4-2 shape, which I think they did, it necessitates having somebody who can then fill in out wide. And oftentimes, I think I sent you both this clip, it requires Chiesa to sprint 45 yards to get back into position. Yeah. And sometimes even then, if the ball's on that side, he's just kind of running from point to point, trying to put out fires and doesn't end up doing that. I would argue even the penalty comes about because Porto counterattack, they play it out wide to Correa, who has no one near him because Chiesa is committed forward and Ronaldo hasn't tracked back. Now you have to have people slide out and people cover. And then you end up having a bit of a chaotic moment. And that's where I think that penalty ends up being conceded because of some of the overloads, I would say self-inflicted overloads at that, that Juve presented.
So it was a curious formation, as you say there, Taylor, with, and Cuadrado had a very good night playing sort of that right wing back position and pushing up when Ramsey went central, as you say. And it seemed like a lot of this was about Cuadrado putting really good balls into the box. And they did that many a time. And Chiesa becoming sort of a really big game player for Juve in this circumstance.
Yeah. I mean, that finish off the Ronaldo like layoff is, I just enjoy how, I'm sure he was aiming for that, but whenever you put it like that high and that close to the far post, there is a little vague feeling of luck, but the power and sort of like just the force behind that shot, it's so pretty. And yeah, then a great header from him. But you're right to point out Cuadrado, and I think that's, to go back to my earlier point about Porto, I think that's where that midfield three was so important, that as their legs got a bit more tired, as they're playing a man down for much longer, they're not able to close down as much. And I think it gives Cuadrado just that extra second, that extra half second to be able to really spot the run he wants, to spot the space he wants to play that ball into, as opposed to, I've got somebody running at me, I've just got to put this in the box and hope it works out.
Yeah, didn't quite work out for Juventus, of course, on the night. It felt like they could have got that extra goal they needed, though, didn't it, Taylor, at some points?
I was kind of shocked they didn't, because as soon as Chiesa gets that second one, it feels for all the world like, here we go, Porto, man down, they've had to change their approach, they're getting tired, Juve have all the confidence. And I think it's a credit to Conte Sao that he makes some of those substitutions that we've talked about. And then I think it's just the fight that they show, maybe a little bit of cynical fight as well. But I think it's the ability to close down and fight for every single ball that's coming in that not nullifies necessarily, but I think there's another world in which they don't respond to that second goal quite as swiftly, quite as directly. And then Juve get another one and maybe another one. And I think that Porto are able to kind of stop the bleeding despite being a man down, figure some things out, limit Juve's chances. I tweeted that I had to go pick up my daughter, so I was hoping it ended in regulation. And I ended up going to get her. I came back for the last couple minutes of extra time. Or yes, extra time. No. I don't know. What do you all call it, Ryan? Because we would call it overtime.
Extra time.
Extra time. Yeah. Then added time is injury time. There we go. Okay. And I really did expect it to be Juve like 3-1 up or 4-1 up at that point. And that it wasn't, I think, speaks volumes of that defensive solidity of Porto. And I think to your earlier point of Pepe sort of reminding everybody that he will break them physically if they don't do like the defensive work that he requires them to do. Yeah, Joe as well, obviously. The dictator has influence there too.
Well, I think the dictator, certainly his shadow was cast over Andrea Pirlo in this game. And speaking of Andrea Pirlo, Joe, is this a big indictment of him? If you look at Juventus' season, you know, not necessarily in the position they want to be in Serie A and going out at this stage of the Champions League, this is the third straight season since signing Cristiano Ronaldo when Juventus have failed to progress past the quarterfinal stage. And bear in mind, they've been in the final itself twice in 4 years before he joined. How damning is this for Pirlo, do you think, Joe?
Man, I don't know. Maybe I'm more lenient than you guys, because I remember we talked about Frank Lampard and Thomas Tuchel, and you guys are all over the whole Frank Lampard wasn't good enough. And, you know, whatever, right? That's probably true. But
are you suggesting that Frank Lampard...
Thomas Tuchel is a better coach than Frank Lampard.
Okay.
Thomas Tuchel is a much better coach than Frank Lampard. I'm not saying that that's not the case, but... It's hard to zoom in so far into one result where Juve, we all agree, very clearly were the better team for stretches of this game and almost won this game. And if that's the case, if that shot from Juan Cuadrado goes in and doesn't hit off the top bar, we're having a totally different conversation right now. Soccer is it's so difficult to discuss sometimes because fractions can change. Fractions of an inch can change the entire narrative. And that makes it difficult. How much should we swing to one side if the ball bounces out versus the other side if the ball bounces in, right? These are the questions sometimes that I think about. I think, by and large, Andrea Pirlo has done a fairly good job. That's not a popular take with, you know, in regards to a season with Juve so far, but The soccer, he has them playing. Yes, their formations are confusing at times, but I think that's by design. He has them doing some pretty interesting tactical rotations. They're breaking teams down. I thought their improvement in possession from the first leg to this leg was very much noticeable. Ronaldo was getting in some better spots. Aaron Ramsey, I thought, was a great addition over Weston McKennie in the starting 11. I thought Pirlo made good changes from leg one to leg two. The mistakes they had in leg one killed them, ultimately, I think. And they're so close to coming back in this game. I think Pirlo still has a fairly bright future ahead of him as a manager. And if he doesn't, either way, I think it's still too early to tell.
I think to jump in, I think Joe is pretty astute there. And I think that's like that is a hard thing to do, especially in like the industry that we're in. It's always easier to criticize and to say this person's not good enough. They're not getting it right. Look what Sarri did with even less resources or even fewer resources. Like, why isn't Pirlo getting this team to the Champions League final? Why aren't they winning Serie A? And I think that's an easy argument to make. I saw a bunch of people say, like, Pirlo and Gattuso prove that you shouldn't have, like, this generation managing. I don't think they prove that at all. And I think to conclude that is to, in my mind, show that you have already concluded that, that you've already decided Pirlo isn't a good manager, and then you're building your narrative in response to that. And I think to Joe's point, and Pirlo has himself said this after the game, is they're building towards the long term, and that's they're trying to sort of figure things out, having had Sarri with an entirely different philosophy than the managers who came before him. What do you do with the squad as it is? Who do you move on? Who do you keep? How do you get people buying in? What system fits the best with what Pirlo's philosophy is going to be? And so it's easy to say, like, oh my gosh, look at the talent there. How do they not win? And I think there are questions to be asked about that for sure. But simultaneously, I think he does make some good choices in this game. I think he does the best he can. I think I do sort of buy into the idea a little bit that Ronaldo at this point is a bit more of a problem than a solution for them. And I think that's probably a thing that he's trying to navigate. And so it's tough to look at this in the vacuum and say, like, oh, they lost, they should have won. We all thought they were going to win. They didn't, so it's bad. It's not great, certainly, that they didn't advance. And I'm sure their president is not thrilled at the way they went out and to whom they went out. But I think I don't think he gets sacked for this. Maybe if they don't win Serie A or they fall off completely and there's infighting, then we do see him get sacked. But for the most part, I think we saw some positives from Juve, more so than I thought we would see, at least from Andrea Pirlo's perspective.
Yeah, maybe we'll have to see what Allegri's doing in the summer, right? But something...
Continuing to do nothing, I think.
Evidently. Something that, I don't know, forgive me if this is boring chat, but away goals, the away goals rule. I don't like it. I've never liked it. I haven't liked it since 1997 when Wimbledon, my team, were eliminated from the League Cup semi-finals, denied a day at Wembley because of the away goals rule. Leicester City, we were playing in the semi-finals. It was a 0-0 first leg and 1-1 second leg. I find that very unfair that my team were denied that on that rule. And in the modern age where, you know, travel away isn't necessarily a big disadvantage unless away fans are setting off fireworks or fire alarms in your team hotel. We can get to that later. But this is a Champions League where some of the teams aren't playing their home matches at home. And we've got an example of that in this match day as well. So to have, you know, the away goals rule is one thing, but also extra time with the away goals rule. Yeah. It seems bizarre to me that the home team, Juventus, had another 30 minutes to score a home goal, and Porto here had another 30 minutes to get an away goal, which has more value. So they're getting more time to get a goal with more value. This I find troubling. Anyone care to wade in on that?
So I would say the devil's advocate argument, to get it up front, that I have heard before is basically that, like, you both had the opportunity to get the away goals in those 90 minutes. And now, because it's deadlocked, the team that, like, I like the away team in the second leg now has the advantage, but it's an earned advantage. I'm not even doing a good job of playing devil's advocate because I agree with you, Ryan. I think it should be scrapped. And I think that is a thing that Major League Soccer has done. It led to some confusion a couple seasons ago. I think it was a Seattle game when they thought they'd won, but they were having to go to penalties.
Sebastian Blanco.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you. And I like that because I agree with you that if you've both had the opportunity to score goals in the 90 minutes away, it doesn't make sense for then in those final 30 minutes for them to still count more. Like, unless they want to then play another extra time, like, and go back to the other host country, and then we can balance it out a little bit. I think that's probably the way to do it, if you want to do it that way.
Yeah.
Maybe my head hurts.
We should just settle this like they used to in the olden times and toss a coin at the end of 90 minutes if it's a draw. Did they do that in the English game? I feel like they might have done that in the English game at some point. Maybe.
Probably, but they probably had to make it more dramatic and a slow-mo coin flip. I also, like, I'm with you on away goals that I understand why you have to have it, especially when it's a packed stadium and it's a really hostile environment and you still manage to get a result. And I said this on Twitter, it would be a very negative thing probably in the end, but like, if you can, like Sevilla, for example, they had to score a large number of goals to counteract the fact that they lost 3-2 at home. But I do feel like if you're winning like 1-0 on the road and you keep a clean sheet, you're not really rewarded for keeping that clean sheet necessarily. And I feel like you kind of should be. Like, there should be a bonus for keeping a clean sheet on the road. It invites defensiveness, but I guess it also invites the other team to be more attacking. I do think, Ryan, I guess fundamentally there are opportunities for revision here, or maybe for the folks in charge to look at this and think, we could just change the rules just a tiny bit just to make things a bit more fair, equitable, long-term.
Careful talking about revision. It might remind the dictator of Porto about things like revisionist history. He doesn't like to hear terms like that, by the way. All right. Well, we're going to talk about Dortmund against Sevilla right after these short messages.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Hey, folks, this is Taylor from the Total Soccer Show, reminding you that we are inching ever closer to the start of the summer transfer window, which means there are teams that will buy and sell their players early, there are teams that will leave that business very late, and there are teams that will operate in between. But no matter what, it's going to be a chaotic situation. There's going to be offers coming through willy-nilly. There's going to be transactions to be tracked and processed and make sure that enough money is there. There's going to be probably angry clubs calling to complain. There are many things to deal with. And unfortunately for those clubs, there is no sort of business tool that makes things easier, makes transactions simpler, gets the business done efficiently and effectively. But for the small businesses around the globe, there is such a service, Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Whether you're auctioning autographed apparel or selling sleek kits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms. And you can sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. And I really appreciate that about Shopify. No matter how big you are, no matter how fast you want to grow, Shopify gives you everything you need to take control and take your business to the next level. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States, and Shopify's the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. That's as many countries as we'll be selling players in the transfer window this summer. Plus, Shopify's extensive help resources are there to support your success every step of the way, because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/TSS, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/TSS now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/TSS.
We are back. Let's turn our attentions to the Westfalenstadion, Dortmund against Sevilla. This one finished an Archbishop Desmond 2-2 on the evening, with Dortmund going through 5-4 on aggregate, had a 3-2 lead. You didn't like the 2-2 one there? You didn't like that?
Oh, no, that's tremendous. That's tremendous. That's the type of fun that you just have to kind of quietly appreciate. It doesn't play well on air when I'm just like quietly applauding and nodding. But yes, Ryan.
Is the Archbishop Desmond Tutu a popular character in the US? Would people know who he was?
I mean, popular is a word. I would say known, yeah.
Okay. Because like at home, you'd say, oh, what was the score? Oh, it was a Desmond. Like, that's a fairly well-known term. Anyway.
My number one Desmond will always be Desmond from Lost.
I never watched Lost because I never watch anything, apparently. Harry
did
Potter.
Did you not? Or did you maybe see parts of it and you just don't want to own up to it? We're back to this. You didn't miss anything with Lost. You're fine.
My wife talks about someone in her sleep. She says the word Sawyer quite a lot. I don't know what to make of that. Anyway.
We all do. Joe, how's this working out for you, buddy?
Oh, it's going great, guys. Thanks.
Sorry, Ryan.
Let's continue with this game. Borussia Dortmund getting into the Champions League quarterfinals for the first time in 4 years. A rather entertaining game this was indeed, having 9 goals across the two games, of course. Joey, if you don't mind, let's start with Sevilla. I think I named them Poophousery FC in a previous episode, and they did nothing to dispel that title, in my opinion. Lots of play acting here. It seemed Acuna was really hankering for a red card. Diego Carlos getting his elbows nice and sharp as well. It seemed like Sevilla bringing out all their classic weapons against Dortmund here.
It's funny because I think Sevilla are one of the few teams that I've seen this year that can balance that poophouseriness-ticity that they have, but also play some really nice soccer under Lopetegui. I think the way that they approached this game and the way that I guess Dortmund kind of forced them to approach this game, Sevilla had a lot of the ball. Dortmund, having that goal advantage coming into this one, weren't too bothered about controlling possession on their own. And Terzic said, okay, here you go, you can have the ball. And Sevilla were fine with that. They attacked in kind of a fluid 4-3-3, 4-2-3-1. They had all 10 outfield players in Dortmund's half a lot from the start of the game. They were going for it, and it made this game pretty entertaining. Are you guys with me on that? I thought this was maybe actually the best game of the four that we're going to talk about.
Yeah, I'd agree.
Yeah, it's close with Juve Porto. I think just the way that one ended, I might give it the edge.
True.
I'm with you because I think Sevilla did a lot of stuff very intelligently here. I think they set up to try to negate what Dortmund's main threats were going to be. I think that's why, to Joe's point, that sort of 4-3-3, 4-2-3-1 attacking approach, that back four is very tight, very consistently, because it seems like they are okay with attacks coming down the channels, less so with Erling Haaland being involved in anything. And this game did feel so much to me, Ryan, to your initial question, like a bit of a passing of the torch, because the attention that was given to Haaland, even when Sevilla are attacking and they have the ball and maybe Emre Can gets it, and on the rare occasion that he actually clears it upfield as opposed to straight to a Sevilla player or directly out of bounds, like any time there was a 50-50, you could just see Sevilla collapsing on Haaland because they did not back themselves to fight him off the ball or to win it directly. And I think that was a correct assumption. So I think to some extent, keeping those numbers central and giving themselves theoretically a numerical advantage to deal with Haaland, I think was very, very smart. And then to commit the numbers forward to really create a lot of chaos and cause Dortmund a lot of discomfort was really smart and really effective. It just ends up being that one lapse, that one sort of like self-inflicted collision that leads to the turnover, that leads to the goal. That's kind of all it takes. And then once you're 1-0 down, which makes you, 4-2 down on aggregate, you got to kind of go for it. You got to extend yourself, and then you leave yourself vulnerable to additional attacks.
And they were indeed vulnerable to additional attacks. No fewer than the many from Haaland, who became the highest scoring Norwegian in the competition, overtaking Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. 20 goals in 14 appearances in this competition. That's not bad. 4 goals in this tie alone.
I will say about that statistic, I was annoyed. You can see it in my notes, like how many times I had to cross it out. Because first I had, when he scores his first one, 19 goals in 14 games. Like, that's impressive. Then it was 20. Then that goal was chalked off. So then it went back to 19. Then he gets the penalty, and I was like, oh, it's going to be 20 again. And then he misses it, and then he scores it, and now eventually it's 20. But a lot of crossing out in my notes. I didn't love it.
Oh, my gosh. And for the OCD fans out there, Taylor's notes are very neat and tidy.
They're
so
beautiful.
Crossing out, that
Holy
must
cow.
Have infuriated you. That
there
must
you
have
go.
Been very
there
rough for you. I'm so sorry that happened. But I think Haaland's also got the record for nearly killing his teammates with celebrations. He almost did it again here. Marco Reus, not only did he do like the terrifying approach to him, he had his hands all around his neck. He had him in the stranglehold. It was crazy.
Oh, man. It's just, I also enjoy that Marco Reus sort of just goes limp. Like, I know it's coming. Fine, just lift me in the air.
Do you think
I loved Haaland so much in this game. I really did. I loved the trash talk after he does score the penalty. I loved, and then being like, what? Why are you all mad at me when the entire Sevilla team tries to fight him? I thought that was tremendous. Yeah, he is definitely okay with being a villain if he needs to be.
I wonder if Terzic says to the rest of the team, look, if he comes after you, just play limp, play dead, he'll lose interest, or you've got to hit him on the nose. It's like, treat him like a bear. If you ever
make yourself as big as you can and see if it dissuades him.
But he wasn't the only star for Dortmund here. I thought De Hood had a pretty good game. I think Jude Bellingham, this is maybe the best game for Dortmund I've seen him play. And 17 years old, very, very impressive from midfield. I thought, Joe, that the Dortmund midfield were pretty strong here.
I agree. The way that they had to defend as a unit against Sevilla's attack, Sevilla, again, had so much of the ball in this game. Dortmund were back defending in a 4-5-1, and Dahoud and Bellingham were the two kind of number eights in front of Dortmund's number six. And so they had not only a lot of ground to cover, both vertically and horizontally, but when Dortmund would win the ball back, Sevilla counterpressed, and Dortmund had to play out of that pressure. And so I noticed a lot of quick combination play, starting with Dahoud or starting with Bellingham on their sides, combining with the fullbacks or combining with each other, whatever the situation was, getting out of that pressure and then playing an outlet ball to Erling Haaland and letting him do the rest, or letting him, Hazard, and Marco Reus do the rest at that point in the attack. But those attacks don't really come about without quality play and quality passing and awareness from Dahoud and Bellingham.
All right, gents, it's about that time. We've got to talk about the incident or the incidents, okay? Should we go? Should we get to it?
Let's do it.
We couldn't get to it. I'm glad Graham Ruthven isn't here because it involved VAR, and I'm not allowed to mention that acronym around him anymore. But we had this situation where essentially Erling Haaland scored a pretty decent solo effort from an acute angle, and it was ruled out. So Haaland scores this goal. VAR calls a penalty instead because Haaland was fouled in the box in a previous passage of play. I think it was Koundé, if I remember correctly, who committed that foul. So then Bono, the goalkeeper, saves the penalty, saves the rebound, gloats in Haaland's face to a rather large extent. Then Sevilla bring the ball down the other end and they try to counter before VAR determines that Bono's feet were off the line when the penalty was taken. They retake the penalty, which Haaland converts and exchanges with Bono the gloating where, Bono celebrated too early. He was stuck in a moment he couldn't get out of. Haaland had the edge, blah, blah, blah. I got those ones out there. But my issue with this passage of play, gents, is that a penalty was given for denying a goal-scoring opportunity when a goal was scored. That doesn't make sense to me, Taylor.
I mean, two wrongs don't make a penalty, I guess, or don't make a goal. If you rob somebody because you yourself were robbed, that you're not justified in that action. And I think that's the best analogy I can go with here, because as my understanding is that when Haaland goes in for that 50 challenge, knocks Fernando off the ball, not Fernandinho. Always have to make sure I get that right. The goal is given. I think the replay shows that maybe it's to the back of the shoulder as opposed to the side of the shoulder, which means it's in the back, which means it's barging into the back, which means it's going to be a foul. So I think they're giving the foul. They're saying, okay, so the goal's not going to stand, but then there's this past incident that we have to look at. And in that incident, the jersey's pulled back. It limits Haaland's ability to get in behind and get in on the ball. So then we are going to give a penalty for that one. So it's weird that it happens. I think it would have been almost more useful to be able to understand what happened if the goal is chalked off, then they resume play, then they look at the other sequence. Because it feels like the two are connected when in reality they're really not. It's just the timeline is so condensed that he ends up looking at two replays in the same sequence, which I don't think is necessarily what they're going for, but I guess what was required here. So that's the best way I can understand it. I don't know if that helps, Ryan.
I've been sitting here working on my Scottish accent, and ultimately I think the best thing for all of us and for the listeners is that I don't actually try, but I just want to get out there. I'm Team Graham. My biggest thought to do with this before I turn it back to you, Ryan, is that Erling Haaland is really good at soccer. Thank you. That's it.
I mean, that's compelling. And once again, the king of analysis, Joe Lowry, wins the day with that one. I think there's a VAR issue here, because I've seen some people comment how that incident wasn't clear and a clear and obvious error necessarily. And it wasn't missed because the referee's looking at it. So whether it was an appropriate use of VAR as well is another issue. But I find it a little bit bizarre when the net result is a goal was ruled out to give a penalty. So,
and Ryan, I think this is the thing that you've talked about before on different episodes. I think sometimes the frustration with VAR is a little bit overblown. I think sometimes yelling at VAR about the lines where it's like, that's the offside rule. If you're using it to enforce offside, that's what it's going to be. I think that's a little bit unfair. Where I do sort of agree with you is that I think anytime you start to cut down clips and clips and clips and clips and you see just abbreviated versions of it, it starts to be harder to interpret. And I would say the Taremi penalty in the Porto game is a good example of that. When I watched those replays over and over again, I went along with the commentator's point of oh yeah, he is sort of trying to invite contact. He is stepping into it. If anything, he's the one who hits Demiro. So it shouldn't have been a penalty. And then you watch it again live and it's like, oh no, he's just trying to step across to screen the ball and Demiro barges into him. And I think there is something to be said to your point for if you see it live and you see exactly what's happening in the moment, sometimes I think that is a good indicator of what's happened. There are times when you're going to miss it or your angle is wrong. But I think when you break it down and watch like this half second as opposed to the full 3 seconds, which is still an insane distinction to have to make, it can be a little bit more confusing. It can feel a little bit more like, I don't really know what I'm looking at anymore. It feels like the Zapruder film as opposed to a Champions League game.
Joe, I've got a couple of questions for you about Sevilla as well. Well, maybe a statement and a question. And Nasri, I thought, scored the perfect header and the perfect penalty. A very rare combo because there was absolutely nothing you could do about either. Both were absolutely textbook superb. But with De Jong coming on as a substitute, for me, I was wondering why he wouldn't be in this match earlier. Is there any reason you can give me for that?
I think Sevilla's biggest difficulty was that they struggled to create chances in the middle of the attack and in zone 14, that area right in front of the middle of the box. I think Sevilla had a lot of good things going in possession, but they were kind of lacking that number 10 quality in the middle and lacking a player who could bring those chances to the surface and actually allow them to penetrate in the middle of Dortmund's defensive shape. I don't think Luke de Jong helps with that. I think he doesn't actually boost their ability to make things happen. He boosts maybe their ability to convert chances, but that's not really addressing the problem. That's kind of just papering over the problem. I think if I'm Lopetegui, that's probably why de Jong doesn't come in sooner in this game.
Is it a similar story with Papu Gomez?
I think so. Papu Gomez comes in, if I'm not mistaken, after Sevilla go down by 2 goals. Is that right? Do I have that timeline right?
Yes, correct.
He comes in along with de Jong. But Papu Gomez, I think, is that player who Lopetegui wants to create the chances, and he wants him to be the dominant ball player. But Dortmund's defensive block was too set. Sevilla still couldn't break through enough, at least, to win this game. But I think that was what Papu Gomez's role was intended to be.
Fair enough. All right, gents, those were two very, very entertaining games we had on the Tuesday. Any more on these ones before we move on to Wednesday's action? Taylor, anything from you?
We can kind of connect this to the Leipzig game, but I think Leipzig and Dortmund are so confusing to me because at times they both look very dominant and at times they look completely toothless. And like, I want to throw out an idea for you all to think about or completely reject if you want. Like, is there an idea that if you try to game plan for Dortmund, like specifically Dortmund here, that almost is not the best idea? Like, I feel like it's better just to play your game and do what you do naturally and not try to counteract and negate things that Dortmund do. And to some extent, I feel like that makes them more like less likely to create chances. Or if you're building your entire defense around don't let Erling Haaland have the ball, when he gets the ball, I feel like it creates this nervousness. And I have a hard time understanding why Dortmund looks so good against a team that is completely set up to negate everything that they're offering. And yet, against teams that are sort of doing what they would be doing normally, or like smaller Bundesliga clubs, they tend to struggle and be less effective. And I don't quite know why that's the case.
Taylor, I think you just opened a can of worms that soccer coaches have been trying to answer and to put back in the can for a very long time regarding philosophy and how you should approach games. And I wish I had an answer for you, buddy. I really do.
I mean, maybe it's just to press the lid down more tightly.
Yeah, push harder.
Maybe that's
everybody.
The solution.
If only we all had a minute or two to contemplate this. And now, some commercial messages.
This episode is brought to you by LinkedIn Jobs, who would like to remind you when you're hiring for your small business, you want to find quality professionals that are right for the role. You don't want to end up with Ryan, Graham, and Joe. Just kidding. Just kidding. Very much just kidding. Because I was very fortunate to have the three of them all join the show. And I had existing relationships with all three of them that allowed me to know that they could handle the amount of work that would be required, that they could be diligent in their tasks and be very effective on mic. And all three of them are. But again, that's because you have the existing relationship. If you don't feel like you have that with potential hires, then LinkedIn is going to make it very, very easy, and they're going to make it feel like you're connected to that person. They have a vast network of more than a billion professionals, which makes it the best place to hire because it gives you access to professionals you can't find anywhere else. But when you are setting the requirements and making it very specific as to what you're looking for, you can very quickly narrow it down to find the right candidate for that position. Hiring is easy when you have that many candidates, so easy, in fact, that 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours.
And LinkedIn is constantly finding ways to make the process easier. They even just launched a feature that helps you write job descriptions, making the process even easier and quicker. 2.5 million small businesses use LinkedIn for hiring, and you can too. Post your job for free at linkedin.com/TSS. That's linkedin.com/TSS to post your job for free. Terms and conditions do apply. Thank you very much to LinkedIn for sponsoring today's episode.
We are back. We are talking Champions League, more specifically the Wednesday evening games. It's Liverpool against Leipzig we're going to deal with first up. 2-0 on the night, just like it was in the first leg. This one taking place in Budapest, very much not Bucharest. Maybe Liverpool need to play all their games, their home games in Budapest now, because, you know, they got the job done here. Red Bull gives you wins, etc., etc. Taylor, is it just me, or was this very, very similar to the first leg in that I found them relatively indistinguishable in my mind?
It is not just you. I really thought this was going to be, and maybe that's because I had expectations and hype around this one, but Nagelsmann being Nagelsmann, I thought we were going to get, if not a completely different approach, then a much more aggressive, much more like, okay, we know what Liverpool have and don't have, and we can like focus in on their vulnerabilities and overload this side, or like create these like 1-2 opportunities that we didn't have in the first leg. And he changes some things, certainly, but I didn't really see that. And if anything, I felt like Liverpool were almost never out of second gear, and yet still got a convincing win here. They had so many chances. I think they could have won this game 4-0, 5-0 potentially. And that completely blew my mind, because I watched this one from start to finish, in contrast to the Dortmund game where I switched at halftime to watch Juve v Porto, because it felt like, okay, this one's done, that one's not. Here, I kept expecting Leipzig to change things and find a way back in, and they didn't. And I think that is certainly to some extent maybe them not being up for it and getting some things wrong, but it's also definitely Liverpool having that fight, maybe Liverpool figuring some things out, and maybe the narrative is correct that it is Liverpool just prioritizing trying to win the Champions League, because that seems like the most direct way they can qualify for next year's competition.
Joe, is that damning of Ripple, Russian Bolsport Leipzig, of course, which they are known
as. They know what they are.
They know what they are indeed. But, you know, they're the second best team in the Bundesliga, you know, taking Bayern quite closely this season. And then they get completely outplayed by a Liverpool team who aren't at their best at the moment, who, as Taylor says, were pretty dominant, lots of chances. They open RBL. They opened them right up here, didn't they? Is that a bit damning for Red Bull Leipzig? I've called them that again. Goodness me. Sorry.
It's okay. I think we're all on the same page with that one. It wasn't a good game for RB Leipzig. I don't know. Again, it's really hard. Maybe this is just a me thing, but it's really hard for me to zoom all the way out and look at this game as a representation of Leipzig's whole season. But I do think this was not the best performance from Julian Nagelsmann's team. They were not able to break Liverpool down consistently enough to create the quality chances that they needed to win this game. That, for me, is the main Leipzig point from this match. They couldn't break through often enough to get the goals they needed to come back from that 2-0 deficit from the first leg. And that's what needed to happen. So yeah, this performance from Leipzig was not good enough for them. Julian Nagelsmann did make some changes. I thought they exploited certain areas of Liverpool's defensive shape better, particularly the vertical gap between the winger and the fullback for Liverpool in Liverpool's 4-3-3 press. There's that hole on each side of the field between Mane and Andy Robertson, and between Salah and Trent Alexander-Arnold. There's that gap, right? Leipzig did a better job of accessing that space, and they had a game plan. They were trying to switch the ball from right side over to the left side to take advantage of Liverpool defending narrowly. They had an approach, but kind of, Taylor, you were along this line already. It wasn't enough, right? The players didn't play well enough to, Nagelsmann maybe didn't address the things that he needed to, but I think ultimately this is just not the quality of performance from Leipzig that they needed to advance, but I don't know that that speaks to their entire season.
Does this game affect,
I think it speaks to my, for, sorry, Ryan, for me, it speaks to my sort of like, my broad understanding of Leipzig, which is potentially unfair, but in looking up like their historical record and their record of winning silverware, I was surprised.
Record.
What's that?
Historical record of Leipzig, was that?
Yeah. Well, knowing okay. That they kind of start in the lower divisions with a different name, and then they change the name, and then they work their way up. Can you guess the last time they won something? knowing that they had to work their way up.
2014.
They won the Regional Liga Nordst in 2012-2013. They finished runners-up in the Three Liga, which is how they got promoted to the Zwei Bundesliga, where they were runners-up. And then they got their way into the Bundesliga, where they were runners-up in 2016, runners-up for the DFB Pokal. And I guess my point there is that this isn't a team that I think of as like, okay, they can win silverware. They can find a way to get it together, to go all the way, to win a cup, to go very, very deep and win the Champions League, to really push Bayern and eventually overtake them. Like, in my mind, again, maybe a lazy narrative, but I'm trying to say that it feels like it's more than just, they just don't seem like they're putting it together, Bayern are dominant. It feels like until they do that, until they win a DFB Pokal or they do win the Bundesliga, I'm always going to have that little nagging suspicion of like, but can they get it over the line? Can they find a way through? And in this game, I thought maybe this was the opportunity to, as we saw with Mbappe and Haaland, sort of cement their, like, we're the next team, we're the up-and-comers. And instead, a Liverpool team that still had some of the issues we've talked about with Liverpool. We do have some players moving back into midfield where they're more comfortable, like Fabinho, which allows maybe Thiago to have more freedom. But it was still a Liverpool team that are weaker than the Liverpool team that won the Champions League. They're certainly weaker than the Liverpool team that won the Premier League, but here they didn't look that weak. And to me, that is a slight condemnation of RB Leipzig.
Well, let's move on to Liverpool then. You mentioned Fabinho there, who seemed to be the biggest difference maker in this team, in my opinion. Having him back in midfield, very, very important. Having two, you know, kind of natural centre-backs behind him with Kabak and Phillips. It seemed Fabinho was quite central to slowing Leipzig down, you know, breaking stuff up, doing defensive midfielder stuff, which they might have missed from him. And I think that Thiago benefited from having Fabinho there as well, didn't he? So giving him that shield to do Thiago things as well, Joe.
I want to be clear. You guys do a great job on the weekend reviews. I love what you bring to the table, Ryan, you and Taylor and Graham. I am not team trash Thiago, by the way. I just want to make that clear as, you know, as the three of us get a chance to talk. I am not affiliated with that weekend review crew in that way. I think Thiago is an excellent player, and I think he's been good for Liverpool in a role that maybe isn't the same as what he's used to doing for Bayern Munich, or has been used to doing for Bayern Munich in the past. But anyway, that's a quick little aside I had to say to vindicate myself. Ryan, at this point, I'm not going to lie to you. I've totally forgotten the question, so I'm just going to talk about Liverpool. Hopefully that's cool with you. I'm going for
it. You could just ask him to repeat the question, you know.
Okay, yeah, Brian, you want to repeat the question?
No, I want you to go now. Obviously, get out of this hole.
I think Liverpool's midfield, because I know that's what you were talking about before, you know, with Fabinho. I think their midfield was really good in this game. The way that Jurgen Klopp adjusted the personnel to have actual midfielders and actual center backs, which is not to say that he hasn't been doing that in the past. He just has had 80,000 injuries, so it's not really on him. But the personnel he puts out there executed the game plan really well. Fabinho, Wijnaldum, and Thiago congested that midfield. Diogo Jota dropped back at times. Kabak or Phillips moved forward into midfield at times to deal with all of the central players that Leipzig had, because they had a lot of guys in the middle. That's kind of their brand under Julian Nagelsmann. Liverpool dealt with that very well and made life difficult for Leipzig, and I think they deserve all the credit in the world for being really difficult to break down, really difficult to stop in possession, really difficult to stop in transition. Liverpool, on their best day, and I think yesterday was their best day as we're recording on Thursday, they're really, really hard to beat.
But obviously, like, they have not been consistently hard to beat of late. They have been dropping results. And I think, again, to, like, Joe, your point about Pirlo, this is one of those games where if the scoreline goes the other way, it's another example of Klopp changing things up and trying a different combination and it not working. This time it does work. And I think I am sort of inclined to give him credit for this one, as opposed to saying like, oh, but it could have gone the wrong way. Cause I think we see him learning from what's not been working. I think he doesn't try Mohamed Salah central here. He puts him out on the right wing. He puts Jota more central. I think, like, returning Fabinho to the midfield, but that allows Wijnaldum as well to be in his more comfortable position. We've seen him central and that hasn't worked as well. So I do think there's a reality in which he does more of this sort of adjusting and it doesn't work. And it's more of the narrative of Klopp doesn't know what his best team is or how to get the best out of his players. But here, I think this is an example of him putting people in positions where they're more comfortable to do things that come more naturally. And we see them look pretty dominant from start to finish. I would say, again, a little bit profligate in front of goal. But other than that knock, I thought this was a pretty comprehensive victory for Liverpool.
Well, up next for Liverpool, away days at Wolves and Arsenal, so they maybe be given a bit of confidence by this victory. So we shall see about that. Last game we're going to cover, gents, last but not least, Paris Saint-Germain against Barcelona. This one finished 1-1. Archbishop Desmond 1-1 on the evening.
Paris Saint-Germain. You could have gone with the giant for Game of Thrones if you wanted to do that. 1-1, okay, the giant for Game of Thrones. Is this thing on? Anybody? Anybody?
Next time. Yeah, we hear you. We loud and clear. this one had an early start for Barcelona, with a PSG supporter reportedly getting into a hotel room in Barcelona's hotel, triggering the fire alarm at 5 a.m. because apparently, I don't know, I suppose people from Barcelona do go to bed quite late, so that is middle of the night perhaps for them. And that fan got arrested for his mischief. But, you know, this one finishing 5-2 to PSG on aggregate, PSG going through, of course. But for the run of play, it felt like Barcelona were certainly dominant for the most part in this fixture, Joe. They had the intensity. Perhaps it dropped off in the second half and PSG got more into it in the second half. But Barcelona, at least in the first 45, looking pretty good here, Joe.
Yeah, Barcelona had a giant hill to climb in this one, but they were very good for large stretches of this game, I thought. And I'm glad that you agree, Ryan. PSG didn't have the motivation necessarily to come out and really go for it, because they have that multi-goal lead headed into this game. And that was kind of predictable, right? That would be the flow of the game. PSG don't need to run out and step forward and leave themselves exposed. So they can sit back a little deeper in a 4-5-1, and then Barcelona have to break them down. And I thought Barcelona, yeah, looked good, looked very capable of doing that. One of the things that I've really enjoyed from Barcelona all throughout this season, even as Ronald Koeman has struggled with different things and as the team has changed shapes and done a lot of different things in La Liga, I think a constant thread has been how good Barcelona look with the ball. They rotate very well. They're very fluid. Messi comes and makes life really hard for the other team. They have a lot of quality possession play, and we saw that in this game. If a few balls roll differently off of Dembele's foot, maybe we have a different conversation. If that penalty goes in from Lionel Messi in the first half and Barcelona extend their lead, we have a different conversation as well. Barcelona looked good, and they're out of this competition, yes, but I think Ronald Koeman and the rest of that team should actually be fairly happy with how their results have been going recently.
Yeah, hard to argue with that, with the last few results. Barcelona playing with the back three again here, with De Jong in the middle as a central centre back. Taylor, you had thoughts on this formation, a 3-4-1-2 ostensibly. What did you make of that setup?
Well, it's what we've seen from them, like, pretty consistently, pretty recently. We also did see, I think Joe and I talked about this when we were talking about Serginho Dest's performance this weekend. They did also shift to a back four and went back to that more conventional 4-3-3 at some point, I think at halftime this past weekend.
Yeah.
So when they made some of the adjustments they made in game, I thought that's what they were going to do. Oh, they're going to a back four. Mingueza comes off. They're kind of doing what's more familiar. And they didn't really. They stuck with that back three / back five. I thought it did work pretty well for them. I thought for an American perspective, Serginho Dest was more involved in the attack. I think we saw him and Jordi Alba very high up the field very consistently, and that's not a thing we saw at the weekend. That feels like a thing they've worked on and tried to balance a bit more in their attack. I think having Messi, it reminded me a lot of what Atalanta do, or what they did with Papu Gomez, where they're in that back three. Then there's the kind of two midfielders that are, their job is to stay central and make sure everything stays orderly. And then you've got Lionel Messi kind of free to do whatever he wants, with Dembele and Griezmann ahead of them. I think it puts a lot of people in a lot of positions to shine and do what comes naturally to them. And I think that is a big part of how you have success, is putting players in areas where they know exactly what to do by instinct and because they've done it 1,000 times, as opposed to having to figure it out on the fly. So I think he made some smart choices. I think so too did Pochettino. And I think that's what this ends up being to me. I will own in the way that Joe defends Thiago. I think Mauricio Pochettino is a very good manager, and I think people knock him for any number of reasons. But to some extent, I think that both of these games, our takeaway was they were sort of boring, is a testament to how good of a manager Jurgen Klopp is and how good of a manager Pochettino is. Because a different PSG manager with this lead overthinks it maybe, or tries to do too much, or tries to roll the dice too much. And I think that he just goes with a 4-3-3/4-5-1. Everybody drop in, and then when we have the opportunity, we'll attack, we'll take that penalty, and then we'll kind of not try to do too much, not overextend ourselves. I think that's a big part of why Barcelona's approach doesn't work as well as they would have hoped.
Yeah, Pep would have overthought it, made 9 changes, and changed his 4-3-3 completely.
This is what I'm saying.
Yeah, yeah, you're probably right.
I did think, to go back to the lineup itself, I was sort of confused because when it was listed, I think most outlets had them in that 4-3-3 because Frankie de Jong is in there. We don't have Gerard Piqué. And then when Frankie de Jong is sitting in as that center back, that seemed to confuse the commentators. It certainly confused me because I thought if anybody was going to drop in and be a center back, it would be Busquets. That way you don't have his sort of aging legs having to cover a lot of ground. You put Frankie de Jong in a position to do that where he's a bit more lively. I think he's also okay with being that sort of more holding defensive midfielder if the situation requires. And so that they went this way, and obviously they don't end up getting a resounding win, and we're not talking about how Ronald Koeman is a genius, but it still was surprising, and then surprising to me that it didn't implode. I'm wondering if either of you have thoughts on why he went with De Jong in the back as opposed to Busquets.
Joe?
I think in this game, the most important ground, if you think about in a lot of games, the most important ground to be covered by a defensive team is typically in front of the back line. You don't want to get exposed in that little area in front of the center backs. Then you can turn and run at them and make things happen from there. In this game and for PSG, the way that PSG approached this match with Mbappe on the left side, isolated, running in behind Mingueza over and over again, and then it's Firpo later on in the first half. The most important ground is not in front of the center back or in front of the center backs in whatever shape back line you're using. The most important ground is in behind on Barcelona's right side, PSG's left side, because that's where Mbappe is going every single time. Sergio Busquets can't slide over to help the right center back cover that ground. But Frankie de Jong can. Frankie de Jong has the speed to slide over and help. Sergio Busquets, I think, would be pretty useless defensively. Well, he kind of already is, but he'd be more useless defensively in the middle of a back three because he can't give Mingueza or Firpo any help. He's not able to slide over and make that happen. So I think De Jong, in his athleticism, is pretty much the sole defensive reason as to why he's in that spot.
That makes a lot of sense. And I think with that in mind, then, it says to me that he's maybe not the most popular manager, but like Ronald Koeman, I think, has some smart ideas with this team about how to do some things maybe a little bit differently than they've done in the past. Even that substitution with Firpo coming in, I was very, like, again, I thought it was going to be a formation change or it meant they were going to do something structurally different. I don't think it really did. I think Mingueza was on the yellow. He was concerned about that. But I also, going back to the Copa del Rey comeback when they're down, what, 2-0, I think after the first leg, they end up winning 3-0 in extra time. He makes this same change. Mingueza comes out in the 78th minute, on comes Junior Firpo, and it gives them more stability to deal with those counterattacks, and it gives them more attacking threat as well. And they end up getting a goal in regulation that sends it to overtime, and then they end up getting the winner there. So I do think that he learned from past experience and tried to sort of roll the dice again. It doesn't end up working, but it also doesn't blow up in his face. And there's another reality, we keep going to the multiverse, or at least I do, where they lose this one 4-0. And then it's a complete devastating blow, and Barcelona are in complete free fall, and they have an election, and their old president has been indicted, allegedly, I think. So I love that nobody knows entirely with confidence how to talk about that without potentially opening themselves up to a lawsuit. But I thought this was as good of a result as like we could have realistically expected from this Barcelona team against this PSG squad.
Yeah, that's fair enough. And I was interested in that Mingueza-Firpo swap as well, because I thought it would give Busquets more license to drop back and make that part of the back four and give Dest more license to move up. Yeah. I think we saw that to a certain extent, but I think Joe's point about the mobility is excellent as well. And I mentioned that fire alarm waking up the Barcelona team. And I think I'm not convinced that Griezmann and Dembele ever woke up from that from that fire alarm going off, because as we mentioned, Dembele could have made this a very different story with some different shooting. I thought Griezmann had a pretty poor evening as well. So I was curious what you guys thought about having, you know, Griezmann in that sort of 10-ish role behind Dembele and Messi here.
And I do that every time whenever I follow it with Dembele. Dembele and Messi, yeah. And I also make it Forrest Gump, Jenna, apparently, for some reason. Since Joe is clearly the astute when it comes to Barcelona tactics, I will just say I love the 5 a.m. Firework alarm wake up, because my usual wake up time these days being 7 a.m., 5 a.m. is the perfectly annoying time to be wide awake, because it's like, I've got 2 hours until I need to be awake. I could be sleeping 2 hours longer, but now I'm awake and it's going to be hard for me to get back to sleep. And even if I do, it's like an hour and a half. Am I even going to get REM sleep at that point? I think it's well timed. At like 2 a.m., you can go right back to sleep and sleep until 7, and you're getting, you know, a good 5 hour chunk there. So I think that was brilliant tactical precision from the fireworks setter offer.
I disagree. 4 a.m. has got to be the sweet spot, because that's, you know, you've just about can't get back to sleep at 4 a.m. and you could viably stay awake at that point. And it's the right, that is the peak annoying point for me.
You know what? I'm gonna concede. I think you're right, because 4 a.m. in my experience is that time when you're like, well, I could, like, I'll like watch a quick show and that will kind of tire me out, and then I'll go back to sleep and I'll get that sleep. And then suddenly it's an hour and a half later and I've been scrolling Reddit and now I've wasted the entire morning. And maybe that is what Griezmann and Dembele did, and that's why they look so sluggish. Joe, your thoughts?
I'm going back to sleep at 4 a.m., 5 a.m. or 5:30, even 6 or 6:30 if my alarm's set at 7 a.m. That is absolutely my course of action 11 times out of 10. Dembele, oh man.
Are you doing it easily though? Do you just fall right back asleep? Because if so,
it depends on how
the
tired
middle fingers
I am
that I've been throwing Ryan's way are now going your way.
Totally depends on how tired I am. And I'd like to say I can get back to sleep most often, but there are times where it does take a little bit more effort. With Barcelona in this game, to move us back on track here, Ousmane Dembele, he was so close to having an incredible game, right? He got into a lot of good positions inside the box. He ran in behind more than any other player for Barcelona, making life really difficult for Kimpembe and Marquinhos. He drew some really good saves from Keylor Navas, but he was missing just that last little piece of the puzzle. And that's soccer. That is how the game works. That's why expected goals is a thing, because scoring goals is really, really hard. And when you hear a commentator say he should have scored that, no, that's not how it works. Otherwise, everyone would play soccer and we would all be multimillionaires. That is just not the reality. And man, wow, reality is a buzzword on today's show. That's on me. I do think Dembele was largely good
at least
in this game.
You're grounded in reality. I'm sending us to the multiverse. So I appreciate you keeping us on this planet.
We did start on Quidditch, so we went from there, didn't we?
We never had a chance today, did we, fellas? We never had a chance. Dembele did a lot well, and he struggled with that final action, that final execution, and that's going to happen sometimes. So I honestly, personally, don't fault him too much for that. Griezmann, I don't think, has ever fit Barcelona. That move at the time from getting him in from Atletico Madrid was always a little strange, because he's kind of a man without a position, but Barcelona aren't set up. They're not set up to allow for a man without a position. They're not set up to allow for Thomas Müller. They're set up to allow for real structure and then Lionel Messi moving wherever he wants. And you can't really have too many people that want to go where they want in one team. It doesn't work out. Or if it does, it's very, very difficult to make work. So those two players do cause some challenges for Barcelona at times. But yeah, and they played a good game. PSG had a very straightforward game plan. Get the ball to Mbappe in behind the line and let him go to work. They got the penalty. They scored the penalty. And at that point, it was going to be nearly impossible for Barcelona to come back in this game. And they couldn't. And that's okay. That's the way life works sometimes.
Joe, can I throw out an idea, and I want to hear what you think of it?
Please.
All right. If you are Joan Laporte, who's just taken over, the new Barcelona president, obviously your priority is to keep Messi and make Messi happy. My feeling is that we have seen Antoine Griezmann at his best when he's in a front two, and he's in a front two with somebody who can knock it down and play him in and be the physical hold-up presence that allows him to move around. I don't think Dembele does that as well. I think I see the idea of you've got these two lightning fast attackers who can combine and it's a series of 1-2s down the field. I don't think it works that well. So let's say they did want to keep Griezmann. That was their priority, is they've invested so much money in him. Let's stick with him. But Dembele is the potential make weight if they have to. We know they're okay with a swap deal because Pjanic and Arthur, that's how that happens. If you're Borussia Dortmund, do you take Dembele and let's say like Ricky Puig, who we don't think Ronald Koeman is a big fan of or doesn't seem to get the minutes that we would expect, do you take that for Erling Haaland? Because I feel like that makes Barcelona better to have Haaland and Griezmann combining up top. It gets rid of Dembele, who can be a little bit wasteful, but I think is a very good asset if you find a way to make him work. And then maybe you throw in another player so you don't have to spend that much money. Who says no in that deal?
I think Dortmund says no, because I think they need another 100 million on top of Dembele and Puig to make that deal.
That's probably true.
But this is the issue with Griezmann, right? Because you're talking about Haaland. As you were talking, I was trying to think of that classic knock it down number nine that can just lay the ball off to Griezmann. Haaland's really not that player. He's more of a, I'm going to get in behind, that's and you're going to feed me. That's why working with Griezmann is so challenging, because it takes a very specific type of player, I think. I agree with you, Taylor, to get the best out of him. It's really Diego Costa and players who fit that mold. But that doesn't really fit Barcelona. That's never fit Barcelona since the Cruyff era, many, many years ago at this point. So I don't know how you make the pieces work. And then even if you do get that hold up number nine, then you've got Messi where? He's not going to defend, so you can't play an Atletico Madrid style defensive block and then attack and be free flowing. There are so many issues here.
Messi's in Manchester in this analogy, I think.
True. He's in New York City, actually, if I get my way as president. But it is a very challenging situation with the personnel that Barcelona have. And I don't know if that trade would work, but I'm here for it, to be clear. It would be entertaining.
I think it would take a lot for Borussia Dortmund to take Ousmane Dembele back as well. The guy they sold for 100 million and has done what he's done.
Bring Emery Moore and Christian Pulisic back and you've got the whole gang back together.
Yeah. Well, maybe that's it, is you have Pulisic go to Dortmund and then you have Giroud go to Barcelona, and we put Giroud and Griezmann together and then they win the World Cup. There we go.
We solved it.
Solved. Yep.
TSS game putting the world to rights once again. All right, gents. I think that just about wraps up our Champions League review for today. Taylor, despite the middle fingers you throw me throughout these video calls, it's a pleasure talking to you once again, darling.
I'm giving you a thumbs up now, Ryan. Right back at you, buddy.
Yay, different hand signals. Joe, thank you so much for your time once again. Excellent stuff.
You got it, Ryan. Thank you.
Bye for now, listeners.